Hello and welcome to episode number 7 of Investing from the Beach. I'm Chris Hansen. I'm your host, and I've got my co-host with me today, Chris Lamb.
Hello, everyone.
And if you're new to the show, let me give a quick background on this. We both worked for IBM. I was there about almost 20 years, 18 plus. Chris, how long did you work at IBM? I don't even remember. How were you, 10 years?
Roughly 10 years.
Roughly 10 years.
Too long.
And so the story on this is I learned the stock market when I was at IBM. It got to the point where I was making more there than I was at IBM. I was in sales, making a nice, comfortable six-figure gig, and got to the point where I was making more, and got the point where you say, gosh, I hope they say something that annoys me, because then I will leave. And they did, and I did. And that was back in 2002. And I was about 40, almost 41 years old. And Chris did the same thing, although he's almost 20 years younger than I am, but he did it about 10 years after I did, and did it with 10 fewer years than I did. So we've had lots of people come up to both of us, both collectively and separately, saying, wow, that's amazing that you guys did it. And I think the thing that's really amazing is that some guy was able to do it when he had just barely broken 30. And that, to me, is really a testament that this stuff is possible. What we have found over the years in talking about this, and we've had many, many, many long discussions.
Before you get into that, Chris, and I kind of want to chime in so our listeners can understand, you know, kind of from my perspective, and you guys got to understand, you know, how Chris Hansen was when he was at IBM. You know, I was an intern at the time, and, you know, he seems like the most relaxed, you know, person in the office or, you know, in IBM. I mean, you know, we're in the sales team, and it's, you know, bear market, 2000, 2001. Everybody was afraid to lose their job. This guy walks around with a big smirk and, you know, just loving life. And you can tell there was a different aura in being around Chris. And most of the people that when Chris left, they weren't surprised because they knew, like, he didn't care really about, you know, any stress or anything, that pressure that, you know, management would put on him. So I was inspired by that alone, and it you know, made me to realize that, you know, the corporate world wasn't the thing, right, for me.
So it's a cool thing. Unfortunately, I didn't make a killing during the dot-com boom. I didn't think it was real. So I didn't get, my bank balance didn't swell, and I also didn't get clobbered by it on the downdraft either. But nonetheless, and I appreciate the feedback on that. By the way, as we've talked over the years, what we have seen, both in our own actions and our own experience, as well as looking at lots and lots and lots of other people, as you're going down the path towards time freedom, and it doesn't matter if you're pursuing it in the stock market, in the real estate market, if you're trying to be an Amazon affiliate, if you want to be a small business owner, it doesn't matter. It really boils down to most people focus on the how to do, the mechanics, the rules, the how to, the strategies, the tactics. It's all the how to do stuff. And that really is only about 5% of what it takes. 95% of what it takes to get to time freedom is how to think. And that's the purpose of this podcast. So today we're going to talk about, or let's back up. In episode number 6, we spoke about where to invest. And what we spoke about in there, if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and take a listen after this one. We talked about the idea with your leftover income every month, you have to put it into something. You know, own some kind of an asset that produces something. And so we talked about that. And now as we get into this episode, episode number 7, the question always comes up, and it's almost like a religious battle. Should I do real estate or should I go into the stock market? And I think people really miss they're looking too much at the tree, and you got to take a big step back and look at the forest. But so today we're going to have a fairly long discussion about real estate and stock.
Yeah, definitely a little bit more detailed into real estate and stocks. We touched on it a little bit on the last podcast, right, on episode 6. But this one we'll explore a little bit more detail into the business of real estate and, you know, other businesses that you can park your asset in, right, in the stock market.
And so before we even get into that, so Chris, since we've done the last recording, you had the chance to hop on an airplane and zip overseas for a little bit. You want to talk about that and the experience that you saw with a, I guess you call it a shirt tail relative, with a small business?
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it wasn't really a chance to go, but it was just, you know, I had to go visit my cousin. She has some health issues, and I wanted to kind of be there and, you know, booked a quick flight, quick turnaround, was there for about 7 days or so. But when also I had a chance to kind of do a little bit of a business kind of, you know, scoping out things to do out there while I'm over there, have a kind of extended family member that runs a, you know, manufacturing plant for furniture, wood furniture. And so, you know, her husband started the business. He spent about 10 years doing it, very successful. Both of them have achieved financial freedom. And so, you know, they're still trying to grow the business and run it. And she's asking me to understand or kind of look at her business and see if, you know, I can connect her with some distributors or customers here in the U.S. And so we sat down. She gave a quick tour of the manufacturing facility, of the warehouse, their retail showroom, right? And so, you know, I see it, you know, all this stuff that she's doing. She says she's got 800 employees. She's, you know, managing, you know, she's got, you know, housing for them. She's got, you know, a cafeteria. And it's like, she says she's, within the last few years, has taken over pretty much 100% of the operation from her husband. And I asked, what's her husband doing? He said he's tired of running the business. He's out more networking with, you know, some of the government officials and stuff like that. And she's mainly 100% on operation and manufacturing. So, and, you know, at the end of the day, she shared with me that, you know, I definitely see she's falling within, she's not a business owner, but she owns a job, right? She's really in the S side of the triangle. And so she's been spending a lot of her time. She's got three kids, but no time to basically live her life. And so she shared with me that, you know, hey, they're financially well off, but they don't have any time, right? And so she wanted to, in within a few years, maybe get rid of the business so that she can enjoy living her life. And to me, right, it doesn't matter what anywhere you live in the world, doesn't matter who you are, what race, we all seek the same stuff. We ultimately want that time. And it was really reinforcing to kind of see that, you know, she's no different than anybody else, where, you know, there's a big difference between financial freedom versus time freedom. That's, right, what we talked about?
That's I was waiting for a place to break in. You said initially she had reached financial freedom. That is so different than time freedom. And people get those two things mixed up. And you always notice in the podcast, we always, always, always say the word time freedom. Financial freedom is not that tough. Time freedom is what you're trying to get to. And so she's got this business, what would you say, 800-ish employees?
Correct.
You look at that and go, she's probably doing, that's a very successful entrepreneur. My hat's off to someone like that. But man, they don't have time freedom.
Yeah. And then to me, unless she enjoys, you know, hey, I'm doing the community service thing, I'm providing jobs, there's a purpose in doing that, perfect. But I think, you know, for them, that business is to generate, you know, profits, money. Mm-hmm. And so if you're involving your time in something that is not meaningful, if not fulfilling, then definitely you're going to feel that it's stealing your time. And I think she's feeling that, right, after having spent a number of years of kind of sacrificing her life, her time.
Well, you said she's got three kids, not able to spend much time with it. There's one thing that's interesting, and I don't want this to sound arrogant. It's really to have people do a wake-up call. So, Chris, when you were talking with her, did it ever cross your mind to turn to her and say, man, I got to do something different?
Not at all.
It never crosses my mind. I hear people complain regularly. Oh, I spend too much time at this, or this one takes too much time to do that. Those words never come out of my mind, out of my mouth.
I think it's the opposite. I mean, the more people you talk to, the more confirmation you get that what you're doing is the right path.
Absolutely.
You know, you chose the right thing.
Yep, absolutely. And so it's always curious to me. You know, you hear people, and we'll jump into this with real estate, small business ownership, whatever, but very similar to what your family member was saying. It's like, you know, I'm doing well, but I have no time. And I look at what I do, I look at what you do, I'm doing well, you're doing well, I got plenty of time, right? And that's a huge difference. And you can't pay for that. You cannot buy that, but that's the most important thing.
And again, plenty of time doesn't mean free time, right? It's valuable time that you get to choose what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I get a lot from people who, you know, have financial freedom, and they have the ability to get time freedom as well, right? Which, you know, they tend to just go to work. And it's because, not because they enjoy the work, but it's because they don't know what else to do with their time.
Yes.
And so we'll talk about that whole piece around retirement, you know, maybe on some other episodes, right? But mm-hmm. I think that's an important thing to think about is, you know, you want to spend your time wisely as well, even though, you know, or you have all that time, right? You need to spend it wisely, or it needs to meet the purpose.
There was I don't think I shared this with you. There was something I read. We all know who Warren Buffett is. His lieutenant or his right-hand guy is a guy by the name of Charlie Munger. And Munger is, I don't know, 90 plus years old, lives out here in a suburb of LA. I think he's up in Pasadena. And he, I believe, is the chairman of the board or something called the Los Angeles, I think it's called Los Angeles Daily Business Journal or something like that. And they had their annual meeting a couple weeks ago. Small little group of people, and they, you know, they listened to the business stuff, and then the audience did a Q&A session with the management team, which basically turned into just Munger. Very similar to what you see Berkshire Hathaway do with their big, you know, Berkshire Hathaway Palooza that they do every year in Omaha. They did at a very, very small scale in LA. And I found something online where I could go read the transcript of this, and it was funny. There was somebody asked Munger something about something related to Buffett. And he said, you know, Buffett has it scheduled where he has so much free time and he spends his time reading and thinking. And then he gets excited. It's like, oh, I have something on my calendar today. I have to get a haircut. Right. And it was, but the point was that he had built in time into his, it's not that he's doing nothing. He's spending the time thinking. Right. And that's where the money is made. But I thought it was fascinating to read that. And he spends a ton of time reading. Right. And it's not that, like you said, it's not that you have free time with nothing to do, but you're spending your time on something that you want to do.
Correct.
That was a great, great eye opener when I saw that comment from Buffett or from Munger.
That's a cool story.
Yeah. So let's go in and talk more about the religious battle that we run into all the time about real estate and stock. And we've got maybe 6, 7, 8 topics that we can point out to in comparing the two. The first one you hear oftentimes, and Chris, I don't know, we don't even need to take a pro con or a, you know, point counterpoint. And we both kind of throw input on each one of these as we go through them.
Sure.
The first one is tangibility. And what I'll hear people say that have a real estate background is, I love real estate because it's tangible. I can touch it. I can see it. I live in a house. I live in an apartment. I understand what it is, et cetera, et cetera. But when I get into stocks, yeah, that's just, you know, it's a couple letters that I see on the screen running across the bottom on CNBC. You know, it says IBM or MSFT for Microsoft, and it says, you know, 150 or 30 or whatever number is next to it. But it's not really that tangible. It's not something that I can touch that I can understand. And so people tend to have, in my experience, they tend to shy away from the stock because of that. They don't think it's tangible.
Yeah, it's just understanding and knowledge. I think for me, when I first looked at real estate and the stock market, you know, real estate was definitely a lot more tangible, right? Because easy to understand. You see that property, you see that building, or you see that house. You know, you live in a house. You don't, right? You don't live in a stock.
You're in one every day.
Yeah, you don't have a stock in your pocket.
Yep.
Right. And so, to me, you know, I probably have saw a stock as just a symbol, right? It's just something moving on the TV,
mm-hmm.
right, or a computer. But other than that, right, it's a ticket item that people buy and sell. They don't really see it as a business, right? But what is a stock, right? A stock is really, you know, a piece of the business, ownership of the business. And so if you have, you know, ownership there, it is very tangible, right? Pick a company you want to own, say McDonald's. You know, you can go to McDonald's, buy some food. There's a store there, right? There's employees, right? There's food. You know, pick a Disney. You can go to their theme parks. You can buy their movies, their shirts, toys.
Think of all the things where you've spent money on the last couple of days. right? You walked into a grocery store, you know, in this area, a Safeway, a Kroger, a Trader Joe's, although Trader Joe's is not public, but any grocery store is owned by either an individual or it's privately held, which means that you and I as the members of the public cannot get into ownership, or it's publicly held, which means we could buy stock in that grocery store. And then in the grocery store, we've got all kinds of various products that we could buy. So you could buy cereal, which is made by perhaps General Mills. Oh, you could buy stock in General Mills, or it's made by Kellogg's. Or there's bread. You might be able to buy stock in the bread company. Or there's yogurt, or milk, or meat, or booze, right? You want some beer or wine, you can own kind of stock or own shares of a beer or wine company. All kinds of things. That's just in a grocery store. Then when you leave the grocery store, you have to go put gas in your tank. Do you stop at Exxon or Chevron, Conoco, Phillips 66, whatever kind of BP? If you're ARCO out in Southern California, we've got ARCO, I guess BP elsewhere in the country. Where else? You can go into a restaurant. So you want to go get a pizza at Domino's, Papa John's, PZZA is their ticker. California Pizza Kitchen, or you can go to Joe's Pizza down the street, which is just a small little local business. Joe may not be publicly held, but when you see Joe's Pizza Parlor, you think, oh, that's a small little business.
Yep, well, they're all businesses, right?
They're and all very businesses tangible. And very tangible, and that's what people miss.
And I think it's not, you know, really their fault, it's their experience, right? You know, for most people I know that have dealt with the stock market, they either don't own the company or the stock or the business long enough to see a dividend payment, or they're buying such a crappy company that it's not making money, so it's not paying dividends anyway. So, you know, when you see the dividend payment and you see the, you know, invitation to the shareholder meetings, and you see the proxies and stuff to vote for board of directors or whatever the company is trying to, you know, do, then I think the tangibility becomes more real. And I think most people don't get to that point. They either hold crappy stocks, or they hold companies that, or they don't hold it long enough to even see the dividend.
You don't stop and think that, hey, this company employs thousands of people, right? Look at mm-hmm. Exxon. You know, you think of it going into the gas station around the corner. But you got Exxon stations across the country, and then you've got, you know, whatever kind of refineries and whatever other things that Exxon themselves is involved in. Or you walk into Disneyland, you think, oh, I'm going there to, you know, for the entertainment for the day or the weekend. But you look at all the employees there, and as you said before, then you've got all the other drag along products, right?
So it could I think Disneyland, the actual theme park, is just a small piece of the business, right? It's just the kind of the front image.
It's an
awesome. But really, their business is all content, and right, it's all the digital assets they have.
It's a people trap operated by a mouse. I love that line. So that's the tangibility aspect of it. The next thing that you hear people talk about in comparing real estate and stock is, oh, but I can make income off of my real estate. So if I buy a rental property, whether it's a house, a multifamily, meaning like a small little plex, duplex, triplex, fourplex, or even a larger apartment building, or even getting into commercial space. But all those, you say, well, all right, I'm going to buy this house for, you know, in the area that we live, common price of a home is in the range of $500,000 to $750,000. So I can buy this house and I could rent it out. And in this part of Southern California, rent on something like that's going to run you somewhere between $2,000 on the low end. If you're lucky, probably two in the $3,000-$5,000 range, depending what neighborhood you want to be in Southern California. And see, people equate that and go, well, I can generate income from that house. And I can't do that in the stock market.
Well, I mean, I think because people don't understand how the stock market works. First of all, the income that you generate from rental properties, it's not that exciting as far as the percentage in returns, right? After you pay for all your expenses and everything, and you're not even accounting for, you know, your time and involvement, right, in managing it. Like I said, mentioned earlier, you know, most of these companies, these big businesses that you're going to store dollars in, or that you can store dollars in, like a Disney, they make money and they pay dividends, right? Not all of them will pay dividends, but if they pay dividend, they typically range from, you know, 2-3%. Some of them can go as 4% or so. That's what you typically see in, you know, real estate type of income, right here in California. And so you're getting one form of income through dividend. And the other side is there is a way to pull income from the stocks that you own as well is by selling something called a cover call, right? And I'm not sure if we need to really get into it, but essentially it's like, hey, you know, giving somebody the right or a lease option, right? Let somebody rent your house and then give them an option to buy the place and you collect dollars for it. And most of the time, right, you're not trying to sell your asset, but you're giving them that option. And what happens is they end up never exercising that option anyways, or you're going to take it away from them, right? But to do that, you can pull out, you know, pretty common, right, a few percentages, right, per month. Right? It can be done very easily in the stock market.
Chris, I think it's okay if we spend a minute on that. Where I often hear the discussions from people is they'll say, it's interesting to me when you have somebody that understands real estate and stock, mm-hmm. and understands them both well, if they've been successful at both, they tend to lean towards stock. If you find someone that understands them both but has not done well in the stock market, haven't learned it right, they tend to lean toward real estate. If you find someone that doesn't understand one or the other, they tend to go to real estate. Yep. But when you find someone that has been successful at both, they tend not to deal on the real estate side. The returns are much better, and the effort is much easier on the stock side. And where a common misconception that comes up, I hear this all the time. People say, well, the average return on the stock market year to year to year to year is, you know, ballpark 8%, 8, maybe 10%. And people will compare that to what they can get with regard to rent on real estate. And they're comparing apples to oranges. You're looking at capital gains on one, and you're looking at rental income on another. And if you compare apples to apples, so look at what the rental potential is off of the stock, where in essence you're renting the stock. You're giving somebody the right to buy it from you. It's almost like a lease option to buy if you understand real estate. And you do that on a regular basis, or you can even do it on an irregular basis when it makes sense. And you'll see, as you were saying before, it's not uncommon to be able to pull a couple percentage points per month off that. You annualize that, it blows away what you can do, a rental return, if you will, off the asset. And then you couple in the fact where you've got the volatility and the potential for much greater price increases that you see in the stock market due to innovation. The numbers don't match. There is no race for second place. It's so far ahead. There's no race for first place. It's a race for second place. The numbers are stunning. You've shown this to lots of people. I've shown this to lots of people that have a background in real estate. And when you show them the numbers, they look at you like, I never knew that.
Yeah. And I mean, most people had just kind of take a look at the boom that we've had in real estate, right? But if you look at, you know, over the course of history, right, compare it with a pretty solid company like Disney or even IBM, right? Just kind of run it through history and you can kind of see the growth is much, much, much more in, you know, a company like Disney or IBM than just your average real estate market.
Mm-hmm. I was explaining to somebody a couple of weeks ago and I said, you know, think of it this way. If you go back 20, 30 years and pick a neighborhood that would be populated by somebody that makes this range of income, and you could put a job title on it, you can do whatever, but just for easy discussions, let's say you've got it's a family neighborhood and the average home there price point could be afforded by somebody who works as I'm just going to be very gender biased here and say you've got a dad, the male of the house or one member of the household is a mechanic, the other one's a nurse. And whatever those salaries are, that tends to be about the salary makeup and the cost of the houses in that neighborhood 20 years ago. Now, fast forward 20 years, that same home, same neighborhood is still probably populated by people in that income bracket. Their salaries have gone up, but the homes have appreciated probably in about the same range. And so you look at that and you go, okay, well, so that says that, you know, that to those two job income, and I'm not picking mechanics and nurses. I'm trying to think of two jobs. It could be a doctor and a lawyer. It doesn't matter. But if you take whatever that salary is that can afford that neighborhood, now fast forward 20 years, you're going to find that it's pretty much probably the same demographic group that is living in that neighborhood.
Yep. Anyway, I think we touched on that in the last episode, as you know, we talked about inflation, and it really kind of grows with inflation. Mm-hmm. We touched on the gas prices, how much it was kind of back then and how much it is now, right? It's kind of, you know, about the same kind of growth.
Yep.
Right. Now, Chris, the other piece that I think most people get excited about in real estate is, you know, not just, it's not the income, but really the capital gains, right? So, you know, they're looking at it from a, hey, I only put down, you know, back in the days where there's all these, you know, ARMs, right? Adjustable mortgage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
People were like just putting down 0% down, right?
Yes.
A few percentage down, 5%, 10%. So they're excited, hey, I'm putting zero money down, or just, you know, $5 on $100, mm-hmm. right? And I could make this big old chunk of money if the, you know, asset goes up in value. That's what people have realized in the real estate market during the boom. Great, right? You could do that. But how many properties can you do that? You know, in today's market, if I were to go out and get my first home, right, get an FHA loan or something like that where, you know, hey, I could put a small amount of money down, mm-hmm. right? And if I wanted a second home, could I do the same? I can't. I'm limited. Right. At some point, hey, you got to show enough income for the banks to provide you that loan. Correct. And they're going to require more and more, right, down payment.
And there are creative financing ways you can get around that. Right. Mm-hmm. Will be the answer back. But it's, I don't want to cut you off because I get a couple of comments. I'm biting my tongue. I'll let you finish.
Sure. Go ahead.
So there's two things to that. So people say, wow, look at this. You know, I can buy this expensive asset, a home, a property, whatever it is. You know, 5-10% down, and control this thing for, like you said, $5 to $10 on 100. It's 5 to 10% on the value of the asset. You say, that's awesome. Do you know you can do the same thing in the stock market? And you're met with this, what? You can do that? Like, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Like, I know. And so, like you said, and you don't have on the real estate side, when you buy that property for 5 or 10% down, you don't have a debt that goes with that. You've got debt service. You've got a mortgage mm-hmm. with that.
Yeah.
On the stock market, if you want to play that same game, there is no debt service. I don't have a mortgage if I want to do that kind of leverage in the stock market.
Yeah.
So I don't have any debt service to make.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if you bought, right, I mean, that's what many people did. They bought that second home, third home, had very little money down, and when the market tanks, right, they're liable for that whole piece of asset.
Correct.
Right. I think what you're talking about in the stock market here is the ability to kind of, you know, own a right, right, to purchase something.
Correct. Correct.
And when you own that right to purchase that business, you pay a small, you know, fee for that. And that's all you can lose mm-hmm. is that small fee you paid for. You didn't buy the whole thing. And when the whole thing goes down, you don't lose. That's not yours. You just lose what you paid.
You lose, in essence, your equivalent to your down payment in real estate. You lose, if it were to go down that low, you'd lose that much.
And then you file bankruptcy. That's
well, in real estate, yes. But also
in real estate, you got to file bankruptcy to say, all right, I only lose my down payment. But if you don't file bankruptcy, you're liable for all that loan.
Yep.
Right.
And if you do want to get out of it, it's not the most liquid asset to get out of. Right, you got to hope that if the market is turning south, if everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and you're trying to sell, you got to hope and pray that somebody shows up with a check. In the stock market, I press the enter key and I'm out. You may not like the price, but you can get to cash instantly.
Yep, and we'll touch on more on maybe the management side of it, right, mm-hmm. later. Mm-hmm.
So bottom line on that, the income that you can generate from stock is, in my experience, far and above what you would see in generating in real estate. And a lot of people miss that. So next thing we'll talk about is the diversification aspect of it. And people say, well, I like to be diversified, and so I'm in real estate. And I kind of laugh at that and say, well, so what do you mean? Say, well, I own an apartment building, I own a house, and I own a commercial building. Like, okay, you're diversified as far as the clients that are paying you or your tenants that are paying you. You might have a lower income, a middle to high income, and then you got a business paying you. But you're not diversified because you're still all in real estate.
Same asset.
It's exactly the same right. Asset.
You, same businesses.
You use a great example and say, well, let me, so that's the equivalent of saying, well, I have a retail outlet that sells whatever. And so I've got a location in LA. I've got one in, you know, a small rural town in Iowa, and I've got one in New York.
Heck, I got one in Vietnam too.
And I got one in Vietnam. And let's put one over in England too. So I'm global and I'm diversified. Like, no, you're not. You have location diversification. You're not all in one on the same city block, but you're just a retail outlet with multiple locations around the world. That's not diversified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if something, you know, some major changes in the market that affects that sector or that industry, right, you will feel the effect of it if all your dollars are sitting in it.
You got it.
And also, I mean, you know, I think most people, because once they start building more and more income, or they have more and more dollars to their name, right, they start to go, all right, how do I add more homes? That's when they'll reach a limit. At some point, they're like, I can't manage all this anymore, mm-hmm. right? Where do I go and put dollars in? So they start to look at other businesses. I mean, a good friend of ours, you know, I think has done that, bought a lot of real estate, and then, you know, he's achieved time freedom, financial freedom. Time freedom somewhat, right? But I think he realizes that he can't keep on throwing dollars in real estate. So he was looking for other businesses that he could park dollars in, and he wasn't aware that he could do that in the stock market. He went out and looked for private businesses and found it a lot more challenging to be able to allocate dollars there, right? Because mm-hmm. there's a certain expertise and it's not as easy, right, to go look for private businesses to invest in. So that's the diversification. It's within the stock market, you can buy a bunch of different type of businesses. We talked about Disney, we talked about an IBM, or it could be any retailer, right? If you wanted Walmart,
could be Facebook if you wanted. It doesn't matter.
Or even a Facebook. You know, there's a lot of good businesses out there that are all making money, doing well, paying you money, right? Dividends.
And they all have a lot.
You can park your dollars there and not have to worry about anything. They're running. They're doing the work.
They've got a lot of employees that are all scratching over each other trying to get promoted up the management chain to make the business run even better. And whose mm-hmm. business is it? It's yours. They're working very hard for you, but they don't knock on your door every few minutes to say, how do we handle this crisis, or how do we make it grow this way? You've got to
make. Yeah, and you're not too concerned also when you have, you know, downturns in the business cycle and all that, right? Because you're truly diversified.
Mm-hmm. So next thing we want to talk about is insurance. And people will say, well, in real estate, it's nice because I can insure it. So I buy fire insurance, flood insurance, whatever it may be. And that way, if my, you know, using my $500,000 to $750,000 home in Southern California, if that burns to the ground, then I get basically reimbursed. And so I don't have risk of decline in asset based on a decline in the value of the asset. So a fire, something like that.
Yeah, it's based on like some type of kind of natural disaster or some type of disaster.
Yep, and usually a specified event.
But it doesn't really insure you against market decline.
Nope. So if it could be, you know, maybe I have a crack house going next door, or the factory in the neighborhood or the factory in town closes, right? Or if you're in, I don't know the whole story of what's going on in Flint, but I know in Flint, Michigan, they had some issues with the water. I got to assume that that's going to lower property values. I haven't kept up to speed on that, so I can't speak firsthand, but just natural initial thinking would be that would be the case. And if you owned a home in an area like that, whether it was a factory going out of business or moving, or if you had a, you know, something that was going wrong in the infrastructure, for example, in the water system in and around Flint, that's very likely to have a negative impact on your real estate values. And you cannot insure against that. But can I insure against that in the stock market? Absolutely. And so I can protect myself for a decline in the value of the asset, which I don't have the ability to do in the real estate market.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody was, you know, when we had the big financial crisis, everybody knew that real estate was going down, but they couldn't do anything about it, right? Other than, hey, let's just dump it.
See if right? I can sell.
And eventually, hey, buy it back at some point. But, right, for those who don't want to pay their taxes and, you know, who wants to, like, hey, I'd rather have it sit in a business than park it in cash, right? They can't do anything about it.
But if it were in a business, in a public business, Chris, can you protect that down? Can you protect against that kind of downfall?
Yeah, you definitely can. I mean, and we talked about options earlier. We said, hey, the right to buy something. This is the opposite. You get the right to sell something. So you go buy insurance. Insurance mm-hmm. allows you to sell it and protects it at that price.
Yep.
For that, you pay a little, you know, small premium. To me, that's having the opportunity to do that is golden.
Yes.
Right? When you're holding a piece of asset for the lifetime, for your lifetime, right? For my lifetime.
Correct.
It's going to go up and down. There's going to be cycles where, you know, we'll see some downturns in the stock market, in the real estate market, in all markets. But the cool thing is we have a tool that we can protect that down. Or mitigate, or not, or minimize, right? The effect of that down.
Correct. No, it's same concept as fire insurance on your property. It's where you have, and these things we're talking about in insurance are known as put options, and you can own a put option on your stock, and all it's the equivalent of effectively fire insurance. When the asset burns or when the asset loses value, suddenly your fire insurance is worth a lot more than it was yesterday before that asset burned. Same thing with a put option. With regard to stock, if the value of your stock declines, the value of that put insurance will go up. Easy example on that. A couple years, maybe, I'm not sure when you're going to be listening to this on the recording, but back in, 15, 16, back in 2015, the oil market was dropping. Oil stocks were falling like a rock. And so we had stocks that were valued, you know, maybe close to $100 that ended up dropping down to in the $20 to $30 range. So a huge wipeout in the value of oil stocks. Now, if you were owning an oil stock, if you had Exxon, if you had Continental Resources, any kind of oil type stock, I'm just naming a couple out there, you'll see that the value of that share of stock declined dramatically. But if you had puts on those, you didn't take a hit at all. And so the value of the stock declined, the value of the puts went up, your net worth remained fairly constant. And now, I didn't expect that we're going to be at suddenly no oil economy in the world. At some point, the oil market bottoms out, and those stock prices rise. And over the last year, many of them have gone double and triple within about a year to 15 months. And so it's a great example. It's just a simple example of what one can do with the insurance on the asset.
And what's cool about it is, you know, since you like that business so much and it's down, you can buy some more. You know, if I like this property or this building and it's down in value, I can't go buy this same building. I may have to go look for another building across the street or somewhere around this area.
There's going to be something different. And, mm-hmm. you know, and not only that, but in buying that building, I have to come up with a fairly healthy chunk of capital. Whereas
yep.
if I want to buy more shares of my oil company or of Disney or whatever company you're in, you don't need as big a chunk. If you're, let's say you own 1,000 shares today, you could buy 10 more shares tomorrow.
You could buy one share.
You could buy one share. And so you can, the granularity of being able to increase your holdings is incredible. That's something to keep in mind.
And you'll find that, you know, in a declining market, right, when you go buy real estate, you know, banks are a lot more reluctant to lend, right?
Yes. Their standards go way up, which means that the buying public, if you will, or the buying pool goes way down. In the stock market, doesn't matter. This is the end of part one of this segment, where we do a comparison of real estate compared to stock. And it's really a discussion about financial freedom as compared to time freedom. The continuation of this will be in episode number 8, which if you're subscribing, you'll get that next week. If you're listening to these well after they've been recorded, then you'll get to hear that as soon as you decide to go click on number 8. What I would suggest everybody do is I'd go back and listen to this again to really try and digest the concepts that we're trying to get across before you go listen to episode number 8. And then when you listen to number 8, I would listen to that also twice, at least to try and get your mind around what it is that we're speaking about with regard to these concepts. So with that, if you'd like to contact us, there's a couple ways to do it. I haven't mentioned this on earlier podcasts. One way to reach us, there is a website. It's called investingfromthebeach.com. And there's more information about us. There's a book list out there. And there's some other items out there that you may find of interest. Investingfromthebeach.com is one way. You can reach us off the contact page there, or you can send us an email, investingfromthebeach@gmail.com. Again, it's investingfromthebeach@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to leave us a message, we've had a few interesting topics that have been brought up on the voicemail. I haven't addressed them yet. We'll address those in an upcoming episode or two. That number, an easy way to remember it, no matter where you are in the world, you can jump on a 747 airplane and within 24 hours be at just about any beach in the world. And that is our number, 747-24-BEACH. That's 747-242-3224, I believe is the way the number works. So email, website, phone number. And the last thing I want you to think of, I'm going to play a sound clip here for just a second, and I want you to see if you can identify what that sound is. And now you've heard that, and you're going to say, oh man, that's just waves crashing on a beach. Well, the reality is, it is waves crashing on a beach, but that is not just any wave. That was recorded. I actually went down to the beach on a Tuesday near my home in Huntington Beach, California, and I recorded some waves hitting the sand. And that was actually recorded on a Tuesday. And if you go back and hit rewind on your player, you're going to notice that Tuesday wave sounds a lot different than any wave that you would hear on Saturday and Sunday that most of the other people get to hear. Our objective off doing this podcast, if you'll master the how to think, is that will get you ultimately to the point where all you hear are Tuesday waves. And let me assure you, Tuesday waves sound so much better than the weekend waves that everybody else gets to listen to. Thank you very much for listening. We love doing this, and we appreciate all the feedback that we've got. And we'll look forward to speaking to you next time.